is the Homestead Journey Podcast, the podcast dedicated to the pursuit of self-sufficiency, self-reliance, and sustainability. This is episode number 102 of the Homestead Journey Podcast. Welcome, 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 everyone. My name is Brian Wells. I am coming to you from 3B Farm and Homestead here in beautiful upstate New York. And today's episode is a bit of a different one in that there will be no Homestead Happening segment because I am recording this episode very early in the week. And I am actually traveling. Well, actually, I will be just having arrived back at home when this episode releases, if all goes according to plan. This coming weekend, I am going to be attending a charcuterie intensive course over in Massachusetts, about a 2.5 hour drive from my house. And so I will be spending the entire weekend over there, actually heading on over on Friday evening, spending the night with Jack Polner and his family. And then Jack and I are going to be riding down to the class together. And so very excited about all of that. I think I mentioned that on last week's episode. So anyhow, all of that to say that on today's episode, we are joined by a very special guest by the name of Carl from the Self-Sufficient Hub podcast. Carl is a homesteader living in the UK with his wife and young family. He hosts the Self-Sufficient Hub podcast and YouTube channel and is 3 years into working towards self-sufficiency. This September, he is actually undertaking a self-sufficient challenge where he is only eating things he can procure himself right down to the salt and spices. So with that said, Carl, welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi, Brian. Thank you for having me.
So you are a fellow podcaster on the other side of the pond. And I thought maybe we'd just start by having you tell us a little bit about your setup and kind of the things that you've got going on your homestead in the UK.
Sure. Well, hello, everyone. My name's Carl, and I am living currently on a piece of land which has got about 8 acres, but we rent it, and we can only really use about half of it. So effectively, we've got about 4 acres that we can really use. And on that space, we've got, well, until recently, we had pigs. We've got some dairy goats. We've got over 100 hens. Got a couple of ducks and a big vegetable plot, as well as lots and lots of edible perennial plants that we've got here. And we are working towards, much like yourself, self-sufficiency, this idea of self-sufficiency, this ideal that we kind of hold up, which is, you know, understandably, and we accept that it's unattainable, but we're always trying to move towards it. You know, it's about the journey towards self-sufficiency, which is one that really excites me. I love learning new skills and all the things that come with it. And at the moment, actually, I'm in the middle of a September self-sufficiency challenge where I'm actually being 100% food self-sufficient in September. And I'm taking that right down to everything, including, you know, salt that I'm getting from seawater and spices and everything. There's absolutely nothing that I'm buying in a shop.
Wow. 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 Now, how did you kind of come up with that idea of attempting to do that during the month of September?
Well, there's a sort of two part question there. So the idea of doing it is obviously just this idea of testing what can be done. And, you know, obviously, as you've mentioned, I'm a podcaster. I also have a YouTube channel, and I am just so passionate, as I know you are, Brian, about introducing people to this idea of homesteading. And it's very, very, you know, it's so important to me that people find it accessible. And what I didn't want, because we're so blessed to have this space here and what have you, what I didn't want is for people to think that it's unattainable to be in any way self-sufficient. And, you know, that if you can't do it all, then you can't do any of it. And so the idea of this challenge was really to kind of test myself and show off what is possible. And I wanted this month to be not a month of me, you know, struggling and battling and finding it impossible and being upset and miserable about what I was eating. I wanted it to be a celebration of self-sufficiency and a celebration of the type of food that you can produce. And, you know, not everyone can maybe go to the extent that I'm doing because they don't have the space, but that's not the point. You know, the point is everyone can do something. So that Absolutely. Was the main driver. And the reason I chose September was because obviously I thought that'd be the easiest month because of, you know, because of our gardens. And, you know, I just thought that would be the easiest month to have lots and lots of fresh produce. You know, it's that crossover between we're coming towards the end of our main crop season, but at the same time, lots of our fruit and forageable plants are out and about. And yeah, it just gave me the option to showcase a ridiculous variety of food. And I've been able to do that. I've been so far, it's gone really well.
So many things that so many rabbit holes I want to go down here. So we'll see how many of them that we could cover. But I guess I would say, as you've been going through this, now you're 20 days into September, so closer to the end than you certainly are to the beginning. Are you achieving success?
100%.
And
100%.
Is there, as you're kind of going through this, obviously you're looking at lessons learned. Is there anything that let me put it this way. What do you miss that you haven't been able to have this month because you're doing this?
So it's kind of ebbed and flowed through the month as I've kind of, you know, got used to certain things. So for the first day or two, it was coffee, although I kind of did a lot of groundwork in the run up to this challenge. And, you know, we started using decaffeinated coffee in the house quite some time ago now. So that was less of an issue. And it was only those first day or two that I kind of missed coffee. But after that, the first thing that I really missed and that was a real struggle for several days was just fizzy drinks, you know, cans of soda. Now, I'm a huge Diet Pepsi drinker. And of course, that's got caffeine in it. And it's got, although it's Diet Pepsi, it's got that sugary taste. Mm-hmm. And I went from that to water, pretty much cold turkey. And I really struggled with that for well over a week, the first week. And then after that, the latest thing, and this has only kicked in the last couple of days, are desserts. I'm really missing, you know, a cake or something after my meal in the evening. Now, I've kind of slotted something into that gap. I'm drinking an awful lot of milk and honey. And that's what I'm kind of having as my evening pudding slash drink. And that really has helped to fill that void of that sweet pudding. But that did that job perfectly well for the first 18 days. And then it started to, you know, there was a crack in my sweet tooth dike. And I'm really craving a chocolate sponge cake with some custard or something like that after my evening meal. Goodness me.
So as you've been doing this, is there anything that you thought that you would miss that you haven't really cared that you're not having it?
The coffee, you know, after a day or two, in the build up to this, I spoke quite a great deal about how the coffee was going to be the biggest challenge, and it really wasn't. And and other than that, I suppose the variety, I was worried that there might be an element of me just, you know, because I'm documenting this. I'm doing a daily video on YouTube, just sharing what I'm eating and everything else. And I was marginally concerned that it might end up being scrambled eggs on toast twice a day. Mm-hmm. And quite the opposite, the variety of my meals has been fantastic. You know, I've had roast pork dinners with roast potatoes, and I've made a take on a Haitian dish, pork griot, with this amazing fruity sauce using pear juice from our garden. And rhubarb extract instead of the citrus, and a stew, a lovely pork stew, lots of pork, you'll notice. But we've also had roast chicken dinners. We've had coming up, we're going to be having crayfish, and you know, sweet corn. It's just been a massive variety of flavors and meals, and that's something that's just you know, a real boon. I really didn't think it was going to be this varied and this exciting. It's, you know, genuinely fantastically fun to do it.
Now, have you been doing this on your own, or has your family joined you on the journey?
Well, it's just me. No one else has got the stomach for it, I don't think, in terms of the actual commitment of doing it, because it's quite a commitment to, you know, to be that strict with yourself in every minute of the day. Particularly my children are at school, you know, they're still going to school. So to inflict a school lunch without a packet of crisps, for example, I think you call them potato chips, is, you know, a step too far for them, and, you know, without a chocolate bar or whatever. So there, it's only me involved. But, you know, the main meals that my family sit down to in the evenings, 80% of that food is shared.
Uh-huh. Very nice. Very nice. So speaking of your family, tell me a little bit about your family situation.
So I've got three children. My eldest turned 16 yesterday, and my youngest is 11, and my eldest girl, and then two boys, 11 and 13. And we are basically living in this amazing house that has got 8 acres, and we kind of ended up here by accident. So my wife and I both work full time. My wife works in a school, and I'm a builder by trade. And basically, I've been doing building work for 30 years or so. And one of my clients I've been working for on and off, she owned several properties for several years, and we got quite close. And we were doing up this property for her to move into. Anyway, just before she moved in, another property came on the market, and she decided on a whim, actually, I don't want to live here anymore. I want to live there. So she went and bought this other property to move into. And she basically said to me, look, I've done up this house for me to live in. I don't just want to rent it out to anyone. Would you like to live here? I said, we could never afford the rent. And she said, basically, you know, you can have it for half the market rent. So what we were able to do was rent out our very, very normal 3-bedroom detached or semi-detached house with a small garden. And for the money that we were getting for the rent on that, we were able to cover the rent here. So we found ourselves from a position of not even, you know, this not even being on the cards to us actually moving in within about 3 weeks. It was crazy. Wow. How it happened. Yeah. And at that point, this was 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago. And at that point, we had no inclination, no desire, nothing in our life was based around raising food. We kept a few chickens, but they were really as pets with benefits, you know, pets that laid the odd egg. And that was it. I personally had never grown vegetables before, much less milked a goat or butchered a pig. And none of these things were even on my radar, but we got here. And I was under no illusions as to how privileged I was to be in this position. And I was under no illusions as to the opportunity that was presenting itself to really make the most of this space and, you know, not take any of it for granted. And that was coupled very strongly with a sense of custodianship of the ground. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't want either myself to look back or anyone else to look over the fence and think, they're wasting that opportunity. They're wasting that space. So very, very quickly, I came to this realization that I wanted to make every single square meter that I could do something and work it. And it just kind of snowballed from there. So, you know, by the end of the first year, we'd put in massive vegetable beds where it was all overgrown before. You know, you couldn't even walk where our vegetable bed is. And I put in some fencing with the idea of getting some goats. And then the next thing you know, someone I know happened to say, oh, I know someone who's trying to rehome some goats. Can you help me out? And of course, yes, I can help you out. And I took a couple of female goats, and just through sheer serendipity, they happened to, well, actually, I'll tell you the story the other way around. I got these female goats, and I thought, well, I want them for milk. So I'm going to have to get a billy, a male goat. And while I was looking for one, sort of half-heartedly looking for one, my wife come running in, and with a photo that she'd taken on her phone, one of them had had a kid. So they'd come pregnant and we didn't even know. And that worked out. Yeah. So all of a sudden I went from this idea that I'm going to be milking these goats one day to I'd better learn how to milk goats. And that sort of happened overnight.
Nice.
We've got a woodland here, about an acre and a quarter of woodland. So we got some pigs in there and we planted a little food forest. Whether we were going to be the ones to ultimately benefit from that or not, I wanted to put that in. Started digging some ponds, which famously never actually got finished. And now, 3.5 years later, we've got bees here. We've got grapevines. We've got two small polytunnels, obviously the goats, the chickens, the ducks. And I personally am 100% self-sufficient for 1 month, but I would say generally speaking, we're probably 60 or 70% self-sufficient on meat and probably similar with vegetables. So this is from a standing start. So really quite pleased with that.
Wow. That's amazing. Now what's your growing climate like there? I mean, what's your growing season?
So our growing season is from frost to frost is from around April through to November in a good year. So it's a fairly long season, but we don't tend to get the extremes that you get out there. We don't get the extreme heat or the extreme cold. But what we do get is a very variable climate. So we can get, we will get rain quite possibly 52 weeks of the year. That not to say it's always raining, but you'd never pick a date in the calendar for next year and say with any confidence it wasn't going to rain or it wasn't going to be sunny. You just don't know. It's very, very unpredictable, but over smaller fluctuations than you generally get on the continental scale out there.
And with that longer growing season, obviously you're looking at a bit longer than what I have. Certainly it's a longer opportunity to grow food, but it's also, I guess, with a lot of rain and so forth, that presents challenges, I guess, of its own. You and I had chatted a little earlier on your podcast that you were dealing with some blight, I believe, for example, with your tomatoes.
Yeah. So we lost every single tomato plant this year. And for this September challenge I'm doing, that was really, really heart-wrenching for me because it just takes off the board a whole plethora of meals. There goes your tomato sauces if you want to make something like a spaghetti bolognese type meal, or if you want to use it as a pizza topping, or they're just gone. And luckily I did have a small amount of sun-dried tomatoes from last year, and we had a small bag of tomatoes that we'd managed to freeze before the blight came. But we had been harvesting tomatoes for probably 2 weeks, and then the blight just came and ravaged everything, and that was that gone. And it took all of our potato plants as well. But we were very lucky because the actual tubers had done incredibly well. So we got a really good harvest despite the blight on the potatoes. But yeah, on the tomatoes, it was just gone. The other challenge for us with regards to the moisture is that we're on quite heavy clay here. So when we get prolonged rain, particularly in the winter, managing the ground becomes an absolute nightmare. There's, vast tracts of our garden that we basically can't use the little ride-on mower on, or the my car, I can't bring that in and do things on the property. And even with the animals, it just means that we need to use really, really low stocking levels through the winter. And the whole place can become quite waterlogged quite quickly, quite easily. You can have it dry for the ground be lovely and dry, and then literally 1 week later of prolonged rain and it's really boggy.
The clay soil is something that my mom and dad fight. And in fact, they pretty much garden and raise beds as a result because they have so much clay in their ground. For you, are you doing in-ground gardening? Are you doing raised beds? Are you doing no-till?
I'm doing, Yeah, I'm doing no dig. So, you know, one of the benefits of it, and I'm huge on sort of permaculture principles as well and sustainable regenerative agriculture principles. And one of the things I love about no dig gardening is you're actually building the soil and you're regenerating the soil and you're building the soil health year on year. Every year that I garden this way, the soil is better than the year before. So by constantly adding all of that organic matter, what we're doing is we're actually aiding the soil in my vegetable garden. We're actually aiding its ability to hold moisture when it's very, very dry, but also to not get waterlogged when it's very, very wet. And, you know, it sounds almost too good to be true, but it's continually adding. For those of you who don't know, I can't imagine many of your listeners don't know what no dig gardening is, but it's basically the idea that you garden each year on a new layer of compost that you just layered straight on top of last year's garden. It's a very, very simple way of putting it. But so it means you're constantly adding organic matter, which is constantly adding humus to your soil, which is that beautiful, friable stuff that's kind of left after your compost has broken down. And that's like the gold standard. You know, we would all love it if our whole gardens were made of nothing but that lovely loamy material. And we're effectively building that ourselves as we go. And not only that, but we're doing it through our own compost, you know, compost that we're making ourselves. And this whole cyclic nature of things and seeing what might otherwise be a problem as a solution. And so, you know, a famous permaculture way of looking at things. So when when we're trimming our hedges, we're not looking at a big pile of hedge trimmings and thinking, well, this is a problem, how do I get rid of it? I've got six different ways I can use those. You know, that's predominantly goat food, but then after that is compost, and you know, the thicker branches are firewood, kindling, and the small leaves can be mulch. It's about when I try and manage my space here, I always try and do it in a holistic way, using from first principles, a permaculture way of thinking and a, you know, regenerative agriculture way of thinking. And everything I'm doing is, and it's selfish to do this, you know, it's fantastically sustainable. It's the most amazing sustainable Swiss army knife of sustainability to grow your own food this way, because it serves so many purposes, but we don't need to do it for those altruistic reasons. We don't need to do it for sustainability. We're not putting ourselves out to do this. We're doing it selfishly because it means I don't have to buy compost. It means I don't have to, you know, dispose of things at the tip, at the dump. It means that I can take what might otherwise be a problem and cost me money to get rid of and use it in place of something I might otherwise have to buy. I don't want to buy chemical fertilizers. I want to make my own, and I want to do it by taking something that was otherwise going to be considered a waste product perhaps somewhere else. You know, the same applies to our manure from our chickens or anything else. All of these things have this amazing value, and they've got energy in them that we've put there. And, you know, in the case of our chickens, we might have paid for that energy by way of chicken food. We might have brought chicken food onto the property, paid for that. And then what are we going to do? We're just going to throw that out? No, of course not. We're going to re-harness that energy, and we're going to use it to feed our soil. It's I love it.
Yeah, and when you're talking about, you know, a problem becoming a solution, one of the things that I mentioned before on my podcast is before we really started, what do you want to say? I guess getting serious about raising and growing food here on this property, we're surrounded by woods, and I hated every fall I'd be raking leaves and blowing leaves. And it was just, it was such a pain in the butt. And I just saw it as such a waste of time, effort, and energy. And then one day I woke up and I'm like, you knucklehead, those, you know, that there is prime stuff to use, whether it's in compost, or I just like to take it and put it in the chicken yard and let the chicken just kind of break it down, and they're making compost for me, and they're, you know, going through and looking for the bugs and the goodness, and I'll take it and, you know, especially the leaves from around our oak tree. And I take those because they're full of acorns, and I throw that in with the pigs. And, you know, so again, all of this stuff that in the past I looked at it as a problem. Now to me, it's like, I can't get enough of it. And in fact, as I'm driving around, I don't know if they do the same thing over there as we do here, but people will rake up their leaves and they'll put them in bags and they put them by the side of the road for the municipal guys to come through and collect. And I'm like, I just need to drive around with my truck and just grab all of this stuff, because this is like great organic material that they're just going to get rid of.
For sure.
In fact, my aunt lives about 20 minutes away from us, and in the fall and in the spring, when I do yard cleanup, she contacts me. You're going to come up and get my yard trimmings? I'll be right there.
Yeah. It's fantastic. And, you know, leaf mold, I don't know, is that a term you have over there?
Yeah.
Yeah. So leaf mold is like the creme de la creme of mulches. You know, if you want to use a mulch on your gardens, you just get your leaves, you put them in a bin bag, a bin liner, dustbin bag, and just let them sit in there for 6 months, 9 months. And then you pull them out and there's just this amazing nutrient dense mulch that's going to serve 100 different purposes for you. It's going to help you keep your soil moist around your plants. It's going to help to suppress weeds, and then ultimately it's going to break down and feed your soil. And that's, I think that was a big turning point for me when I've never once, I don't think, bought a commercial feed for plants. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was always aware that it was something that you kind of should do, or that, you know, certain growing methods would always recommend that you feed your tomato plants or whatever. And then, you know, this idea, the light bulb went off when I kind of figured out that you're not feeding your plants, you're feeding your soil. Mm-hmm. And, you know, doing that can demystify everything. And all of a sudden, you don't need these shop-bought chemicals. You can manage it all yourself. And, you know, for me, it's selfish. Of course, I don't want to buy something if I don't need to. And you don't need to think about it as I mentioned before, as being an altruistic option. You know, you're not doing it out of the good of your heart, out of the kindness of your heart, for the extra sustainability. That's a byproduct. That's this amazing byproduct of doing things the selfish way and, you know, not spending any money on it. I love that. What's not to love?
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the things when I talk about self-sufficiency, self-reliance, and sustainability, certainly I kind of define sustainability more from a systems perspective, but I also tell people there is a sense that when you are serious about raising and growing food and you are utilizing, you know, good principles in doing so, there is a sustainability aspect to that from the standpoint of positive environmental impact that just naturally goes hand in glove with those things. And so I really see us as homesteaders as kind of being the first environmentalists.
Yeah, 100%, Brian. And I often talk about growing your own food as being the Swiss Army knife of sustainability. Mm-hmm. Because it does so many things, and it doesn't matter what your why is, what your reason for doing it is. Perhaps mm-hmm. you want to, you know, perhaps you want really high quality organic food and you want to save money on on buying it because it can be really expensive. Perhaps your goal is just to spend more time in your garden and get connected to the idea of growing plants. Perhaps what you're interested in is the provenance of your food. You want to know exactly what you're putting in your mouth and where it's come from. Or, you know, whatever the reason for you doing it, that doesn't matter to me, you know, so long as you've got one. But absolutely, once you've decided to do it for this selfish reason, you're then, if you, you know, get sucked right into it, you're going to be serving so many other purposes at the same time. You're going to be saving on your own carbon footprint just every time you drive to the shop. I don't talk about food miles. I talk about food meters. Mm-hmm. You're going to be reducing all that plastic packaging that yep. things are going to be going in. You're going to be, you know, if you're using a method like I am with your soil, you're going to be actually building the soil, healthy soil that's then going to sequester carbon from the atmosphere. It's actually going to suck carbon back into it. That's yep. amazing. You know, and these are all, that's why I say, you know, the Swiss Army knife of sustainability, because these are all byproducts of you doing the selfish thing of growing your own food because you want to know where your food comes from, or growing your own food because you want to spend time in the garden, or whatever it is, mm-hmm. you do that for your own benefit. And then all these other benefits, all these other dominoes just start to fall in line in behind it. And I mean, that you can hear, I get excited about this because I just think it's amazing.
I'm with you 100%. One of the other things I think as well is that you value food in a way that you've never valued food, and in a way that an exchange of dollars or an exchange of, are you guys using euro now, or what are you guys using?
We never joined the euro. So that's right.
Pence. And we got the Brexit thing and all that stuff. So I don't want to rip open that wound, but what the pound or whatever it is. But you know what I'm saying? The exchange of money for food, you're never going to achieve the same level of value as when you put your own blood, sweat, and tears into raising vegetables or raising meat or whatever. You're going to be so less quick to just toss it in the bin, because you know what it took to raise that. You knew that animal, you know? Yeah. And so I think just even from that perspective, our environmental impact is so much better because
absolutely.
We're going to want to use every, you know, from nose to tail on the pig, from, I say, beak to butt on the chicken. You know, we want to use every bit of that animal. We want to use every bit of that, you know, those vegetables. And in the case of vegetables, the awesome thing about having pigs, having chickens, is that, you know, if you've got that zucchini that got a little bit too big, you turn it into bacon or you turn it into eggs. You know, that's
yeah. There's no such thing as food waste here. You know, you're really conscientious about, first of all, trying to make sure that as much food as possible becomes human food and isn't mm-hmm. wasted in that way. But even the stuff that can't be, I mean, like, so I processed a chicken. Last week, we had a beautiful whole chicken roast dinner. We carved most of the breast meat up. Then, you know, I picked the carcass clean of the rest of the meat, and that formed another dinner for me. And then the rest of the carcass went in a crock pot, and I made an amazing chicken stock, which I'll be using over the next 2 or 3 weeks. But then even when I, you know, actually slaughtered the chicken, that the feathers, they're going to become compost and they're going mm-hmm. to feed the soil, and we're going to turn those into carrots and all those other things, you know. And there is no such thing as waste because everything has got a place within the system. For my evening meal this evening, I just ate some sweet corn. That's all I had, some corn on the cobs, and I stripped them out in the garden. And as I'm stripping the leaves off the outside of the cobs, that goes straight to the goats, you mm-hmm. know, and they're eating it as I'm stripping it off. And then the cobs will go back into the compost. And there's nothing, we're never looking for any, you know, municipal authority to come and remove food waste from this property, or, you mm-hmm. know, almost any other kind of organic waste, because that's energy that we can be using here.
Absolutely. Now, definitely don't think about just chucking those corn cobs in the compost. You might want to try your hand at that corn cob jelly we talked about, you know?
Yeah, I did think that. And I definitely will be. It's a bit late to save these guys, but on the next ones, we've got a load more. So
good.
I'll definitely be doing that.
Excellent. So what kind of things do you've got this challenge that you're putting yourself through here in September, and it sounds like it's going very well. What are some next steps that you're planning on doing there for your homesteading?
Well, we are in a position of flux at the moment because we had a fairly long-term tenancy. We're supposed to be here a little bit longer, but for various reasons that I won't need to bore your listeners with, we actually are being evicted, and we have to leave our property and find somewhere else to live by next Easter. So as it stands right now, that's why at the moment we don't have any pigs, but I did have pigs. We had a breeding program and everything else, and we had everything kind of set up to go, you know, indefinitely. But I ended up having to slaughter all three of our remaining pigs about 2 months ago. just because the landlord wanted them done and wanted them off the property. It all, you know, everything changed on a dime. And so at the moment, our next step is to basically find our next homestead. And we don't really know where that's going to be or what that looks like yet. So that's where we are.
And for you guys, is, I guess I should ask this question earlier, is homesteading as, I don't know if you want to say as much of a thing in the UK as it is over here, or kind of how do people view that?
No, no, absolutely not. We're very much a minority. I imagine it's a minority over in the US as well, but you know, we're not so much deemed odd by our friends, but it's certainly unusual. You know, for instance, I slaughter and butcher our own pigs here. I do it all on site. I don't think I've ever met anyone in person who has ever butchered and slaughtered anything. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think as I talk to you, and I don't think I've ever met anyone who has done that. That's a lie. No, I know. I can think of one person who did it once, actually. But that's it. And that's because that's such a rarity here. Because in the UK, we don't have that connection within just a few generations back to the pioneers that you had in the States. Mm-hmm. You don't have to go back very far, you know, insofar as a number of generations. And there were still parts of the States that were kind of being colonized and, was still a frontier. We're so departed from that, you know, we're talking hundreds of years,
right?
That culture just doesn't exist here. So it's very much a fringe activity here in the UK, and I think particularly around the raising of meat, less so, you know, lots of people have what we call an allotment, which is, you know, a piece of ground that you would grow fruit and vegetables on. But even those people are definitely in a minority. But I think it's fairly safe to say that'd be the case in the US as well. You know, most people don't actually produce any of their own food, do they? But right. when it comes to crossing the line into what I would definitely say is homesteading and adding things like, you know, preserving and, you know, making ferment. And it was only through doing the podcast and doing the YouTube channel that I have that I've kind of even spoken to people in the UK that have ever even considered things like making their own cheese. It's such a rarity here. And the idea of it is really, it's almost like alchemy. You know, it's something that people don't consider as an option. People don't realize they can make their own yogurt, and it's super, super easy. And I just think that we're so disconnected from that in the UK. I think we are disconnected from it as first world countries the world over, but more so in the UK than the US, because like I alluded to before, you do have that kind of rich connection to your history, your recent history of, you know, the pioneers that really sort of set the standard for what homesteading is. And in a way, we're almost copying you guys in a lot of these trends. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Very, I think a very accurate take on it. We've certainly up to this point, I think, been following very much in the UK's footsteps, so to speak, with regards to losing connection with our food. In the last, I would say probably 40 or 50 years, the ideas of raising and growing your own food and preserving it and so forth have certainly become a lot less common than they were back when, you know, my parents grew up and when my grandparents grew up. Certainly it became less and less of a thing. And it's, you know, on one hand, it's very difficult for me to judge that because I've grown up around this my entire life. I don't ever, well, certainly we lived for a time in Brazil and we weren't, you know, doing the raising and growing of food like we do here in the States. My grandparents were still doing it. My aunts and uncles were still doing it and so forth. And so I still had that level of connection through them when I would come to visit.
I'm just going to butt in a minute, Brian, because I desperately want to say, and the thing is with that is the more we are detracted from where our food comes from, the more we are not connected to where our food comes from, the lower the standards can get.
Absolutely.
In what we eat, because we're not thinking about, not only are we not thinking about it, but it's almost a case of we want to not think about it. Mm-hmm. And no one wants to think about where their meat comes from, because the second you think about where your meat comes from, all of a sudden you have to start asking yourself all sorts of other questions about things like animal welfare. Whereas people want their meat to not look like an animal. And mm-hmm. there are loads of people, and I mean adults, that you could take them up to the butcher's counter and say, right, what animal does that come from? And they wouldn't know. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's obscene to not have that kind of connection and knowledge to the thing you're going to actually put inside your body is ridiculous. But the more people can detach themselves from it, the less they need to think about it. The less they need to think about it, the lower and lower standards can get. And of course, this is coupled with the lower the standards get, the cheaper the food becomes. And it's this perpetual cycle. The cheaper the food becomes, the less and less people want to know what's in it or care what's in it. And it drives it. So it's like a race to the bottom. Whereas as soon as you say, I'm going to make that piece of bacon, all of a sudden you're invested in the welfare of the animal. You're invested in the feed that the animal gets. You're invested in the slaughter that the animal gets, the butchering that the animal gets. These are all things that you're invested in. And not only are you connected to this piece of food that you can then trace that right back to the origin and the breeding of the animal or whatever it might be, but it means that you're not able to say, well, I just don't know. So, you know, it's not my problem, which is too easy.
100%. And the other piece to that as well is, you know, it's kind of funny. In our day and age, we pay so much attention to, you know, I shouldn't say we pay so much attention, but culture in general, at least here in the US, and I would say it's probably this similar over in the UK, you know, people go to the gym. You know, there's this kind of this health mm-hmm. fanaticism that people have with working out, and I run and I do this and I do that. But the best way, in my opinion, that you can take care of your body is to eat healthy, good quality food. And if you're not starting at that point, all of this running that you do and all of this lifting of weights that you do, at least from my perspective, is rather pointless.
Yeah, yeah, and you've just added another another benefit of growing your own food. You know, I certainly don't need to go to the gym.
Well, exactly. I tell people all the time, this is my home. This is my gym.
Yeah, 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 for sure.
For a while, I actually did do the whole go to the gym, I don't know, 3 days a week and work out and so on and so forth. What pointless stuff! I'd much rather, and not that I relish the idea of, you know, shoveling manure, but I'd rather do that than go lift weights at the gym. You know, I'd rather lift bags of feed.
Yeah. 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 Well, what one of those things, you know, works your muscles. The other one works your muscles and achieves something. So it's
absolutely,
you know, it's a pretty easy decision, an easy choice for me.
And the other piece to it as well is even people who do think about food from the standpoint of the health benefits, I think, and I don't know how things are there for you, but people put, in my opinion, far too much trust in labels at the store. You know, so they'll look at something and it'll say organic, or it'll say non-GMO, or it'll say whatever. And so they think, okay, that's good for me. But that, at least here, just because something says organic or just because something says non-GMO doesn't necessarily mean that.
No, well, I would take issue ever so slightly with the wording of that, what you said. I don't think it's necessarily people who trust labels too much. I think it's just people are ignorant of what the words mean. So, you know, I have actually quite a lot of trust in the regulations that our government has in place around food labeling. I actually think they're pretty robust and I support them. But what I would say is that people don't know what the word organic means necessarily. People don't know, particularly in the US, what the term or how the term non-GMO is being used, because my understanding, please correct me if I'm wrong, is that most of the things that you buy in the supermarket, there's not a GMO option available of it anyway.
Absolutely.
You know, so it's purely marketing, and it's you know, marketing on the behalf of the food production companies. But, you know, things like organic, people just don't understand what that label actually means. Free range eggs, people don't know what those words actually mean. They kind of get a sense that it's better than this other type of eggs, and it may well be. But unless you've spent the time to actually understand what it, and again, it comes down to the same thing. If you haven't spent the time to understand where your food comes from, you can't expect to understand where your food comes from. And you can't expect to understand what these terms mean, because you've decided to compartmentalize that portion of your existence on this planet and put it in a little box that you don't want to worry about. And to me, that's the essence of the issue, and that leads to this problem whereby the food labeling, however accurate it may be, can be misleading insofar as people just don't understand what it means, and that's the problem.
That's definitely a point well taken, because I think people look at things, whether it's the non-GMO, and at 100%, that's exactly where I was kind of going with that, is that, you know, people say, well, it's a non-GMO box of Cheerios. Well, there is no GMO version of oats or whatever.
Beyond that, unless it's got corn syrup on it or something.
Yeah, exactly. Or you know, the other piece to it as well is understanding that just because it says, you know, cage free, well, cage free isn't, you know, people have in their mind, oh, cage free, it's this idyllic version of, you know, chickens frolicking in the meadows. Well, no, it just means that instead of them being individual cages, they're crowded in big barns. You know, so, but definitely I guess kind of where I was going with all of that is that, to me, a big part of the reason why I raise and grow my own food is because I know what's not in my food as much as what I know is in my food. If that makes any sense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. 100%. And for me, a big part of it is animal welfare. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've got myself in a bit of trouble before on this topic, but I think, you know, veganism is a perfectly sensible moral conclusion. And I think it's a perfectly sound place to stand morally and ethically to say, I am a vegan for, you know, ethical reasons. I'm like, okay, you walk the walk, you talk the talk, but you walk the walk as well. And I can get on board with that. You know, I understand that. I believe that my stand is equally morally ethical, because even though I choose to eat meat, you know, I try and eat meat where it has had the best possible life. You know, our pigs, they've had the run of an acre and a quarter of woodland. They've had this amazing existence, this perfect existence where every single one of their needs is met. And my argument to vegans, which again has got me in trouble in the past, is to say that these are lives that were better to have lived than have not lived.
Yes.
You know what I mean? As in, you know, if the pig had the choice between having the existence it had for the time it had it, and then a very, very ethical slaughter as well, it would take that over no existence at all. And that those were the options. There was no third option on the table of the pig being released into the wild and living happily ever after. That was never an option. You know, those are the only options on the table. So I believe that the piece of ground I'm stood on is very ethically sound as well in that regard. And I've gone to great pains to try and, you know, go as far as I possibly can. And that's why I slaughter and butcher myself. So, you know, I can have a pig that's was born and raised here on the property, has lived this idyllic life, and then one day it's eating an apple and then there's nothing. Yes. You know, it's all done right there and then. It doesn't even have to go through the, you know, the traumatic exercise of being corralled onto a trailer. And I'm not criticizing anyone else that does anything. Mm-hmm. I'm never, ever, ever judgmental, or, you know, I'm not telling anyone else what to do, but what I am doing, what I'm trying to get across, is that I've made my decisions, and I'm very, very confident and happy to sort of back them up with anyone who would pick an ethical quarry with them, a quarrel with them. And, you know, and that's important for me. That's an important thing for me. And one of the, you know, types of animals we have here is we have ex-battery hens. We've got lots of different types of hens, but some of them are ex-battery hens. Is that a term that you're familiar with over there in the States?
I have never heard that one before.
Okay, so a battery hen is basically a caged hen. Now, the term of battery farming, they were called battery hens because they were like little batteries that just spat out eggs, kept in ridiculously confined conditions. Now, the laws changed ever so slightly here that, you know, technically speaking, battery hens don't exist anymore in the commercial marketplace, but something very akin to them does. And what we do is we rescue ex-battery hens. So they're basically hens that have been used in the most intensive farming methods that you can legally use in this country to create eggs. And then after about 14 or 16 months, they would go off and be slaughtered and become animal food. Well, we rehome them here, and they are still prolific egg layers. Mm-hmm. But part of our covenant with that animal, what we do when we rehome them, is they get to retire here. So even when they're non-productive, when they're no longer productive, we give them a nice free-range retirement, because that's the sort of deal I've done with that animal. You know, it's not had this beautiful life that I would have liked to have given it. It's had a pretty harsh environment within which it's had to live for, you know, its youth. And in return, we get lots of eggs. They're virtually free. I think they're about, you know, £1.50 a bird or something, because they're all going to slaughter. And so we, you know, they pay for themselves, but they don't have to pay for themselves every month, if that makes sense. You know, mm-hmm. as a thank you for what they've given us, we allow them to retire here.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that, you know, the goal of anyone who raises animals, whether it's for meat, you know, even for eggs, is you want your animals to live well. And when it comes time for them to go over the rainbow, you want them to die well. You know what, obviously each one of us has to make certain decisions along the way as to kind of what that means. But, all of us definitely, and this is one of the things that, especially when you're doing it on a smaller scale, the animals mean more to you than they do in these big, huge factory farms. Because if you lose a pig, and out of 1,000 pigs, it's no big deal, right? Mm-hmm. If you lose a pig out of 2 pigs, that's a huge deal. And so, again, as homesteaders, we are, I think, even more, I want to be careful here because I don't want to allege that factory farmers are abusing animals.
I know exactly where you're coming from.
But when you're on that, you know, that smaller scale, you definitely, I think, are more in tune with what your animals' needs are and what their welfare. You're greatly concerned with what their welfare is.
I think you're less likely to make a decision that is based purely 100% on commercial factors.
Correct. Absolutely. And certainly there is a sense to where, you know, I've gotten into these debates with people, you know, whether or not I'm going to take my chicken that's ailing to a vet for a $250 vet bill. I'm probably not. No. But on the other hand, you know, with a pig, especially one that I've invested a lot of time, effort, and energy to, you know, certainly there would be more of a consideration there.
Of course.
So thank you so much for joining me here. You and I could chat and chat and chat and chat, because it sounds to me, I mean, and there are so many things that I, you know, you, I know, are big into foraging, and I would love to chat with you about that. But certainly we've got to come to a close at some point, and certainly for us to connect up in a future episode, I certainly would love to have you back on the show again.
I'd absolutely love that.
And this is one of those things that I think homesteading is one of those things where when you meet somebody else who's doing what you're doing, It's like a kindred spirit, your brother from another mother. And you just, I don't know, it's a connection. At least what I found as I talk to other homesteaders, that it's just unique. There's not really anything like it that I've ever experienced in life. When you meet a fellow homesteader, it's like you've been lifelong friends. And so again, thank you so much for joining me here. Where can people find out more about you and in your podcast and so forth?
Well, my podcast is called Self-Sufficient Hub, and you can get that wherever you're listening to this podcast. Just search Self-Sufficient Hub. My YouTube channel is by the same name, Self-Sufficient Hub on YouTube. And that's where I'm doing my daily video logs of my September challenge, if anyone wants to follow along with that and the ups and downs. And if you're in the UK and you wanted to perhaps go on a foraging course, which I run sometimes, and you're in the Southwest, you can find details of that on my website, which is selfsufficienthub.com, or just Google Self-Sufficient Hub foraging and you will find me. But Self-Sufficient Hub in all the places, also on Facebook. There you go. That's everything.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian. It's been an absolute treat. Cheers.
Folks, I do hope that you did enjoy that interview with Carl. I had such a blast chatting with him, and it was really difficult to know even where to end the interview. I do hope to have Carl back on the show in the future, because it just felt like I was talking to my brother from another mother on the other side of the pond. So I greatly enjoyed that. Thank you, Carl, so much for joining me here on the podcast. I highly recommend you check out his podcast. I really enjoy it. And so again, thank you very much, Carl. And folks, we will be back to a regularly scheduled episode next week. And I will bring you up to speed with what we've been doing here on the homestead the past 2 weeks. All right. Take care, everybody.
Brian can be reached by emailing him at brian@thehomesteadjourney.net or by contacting him via our social media accounts on Facebook, Instagram, or YouTube. If you've enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support this podcast, we invite you to become a member of the Supporting Listeners Program. For $10 a month or $100 per year, you will receive access to a community of like-minded individuals via a private Facebook group, at least one monthly live Q&A with Brian, the opportunity to participate in live recordings of the podcast, access to an ever-expanding library of helpful homesteading content, and so much more. Head on over to support.thehomesteadjourney.net for more information and to sign up today. As always, the music on this episode was provided by Audionautix.com. So a big shout out to them.
And until next time, everybody, keep up the good work.